John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and let's get right down to business here. In the U.S. Supreme Court today, arguments will be heard in a case, King v. Burwell, that is challenging the Affordable Care Act. The outcome of the challenge could affect millions of people, and if the challenge succeeds, it will do something that both parties agree is a really bad idea, vastly increasing the number of people with no health care coverage. Both sides in the case agree on this. So why? And exactly what is this all about? Well, that is a rather rich and strange legal concoction you could only have in our current era of angst, ideology, and divisive kill-it-at-all-cost style of governing here in Washington, D.C. To begin, let's remind ourselves that the Affordable Care Act is one of the signature achievements of the Obama administration, whether you agree with it or not.
For as we mark the turning of spring, we also mark a new season in America. In a few moments, when I sign this bill, all of the overheated rhetoric over reform will finally confront the reality of reform.
Oh, that it were so. What did happen? Well, what actually happened was that millions of Americans got health insurance, many low-income families who qualified through federal subsidies that helped them pay the premium. They purchased coverage through special insurance marketplaces set up in their state, or if their state chose for political reasons not to set up a marketplace, and 34 states didn't, they would use a federal marketplace for purchasing coverage and get the subsidy directly from the feds. You with me?
Anyone? Anyone? Anyone?
At about this same time, one of the well-funded ideological critics of Obamacare was speaking at a D.C. conference and said that the ACA had to be killed as a matter of, quote, political hygiene. I do not care how it is done, whether it is dismembered, whether we drive a stake through its heart, whether we tar and feather it and drive it out of town, whether we strangle it, end quote. You can find this quote in the current issue of The New Yorker.
Remember, get him alive if you can, but get him!
So this is what they came up with. In Section 36B of the Act, there are four words referring to the all-important subsidies, quote, established by the state, 1, 2, 3, 4. You'll notice it doesn't say established by the state or the federal government. Now, the lawyers challenging the act claim because Congress didn't specifically reference federal subsidies and just spoke about subsidies established by the state, that any direct subsidy is invalid, unauthorized, and therefore subject to cancellation, even though millions have already been granted and people have already been going to the doctors for care under the ACA for months.
It was an assumption made by the press. It was an assumption made by me. I'm one of the people who missed this.
If it sounds like more of a spelling error than a constitutional question, you aren't crazy. That's Michael Cannon from the Cato Institute, one of the people making the case for the plaintiffs in King v. Burwell.
I didn't know about this provision until more than a year after the law was passed. And when I learned about it, like everyone else, I thought this was a drafting error. I thought this was something they did not mean to put in there. But Jonathan Adler and I have done more research on the legislative history here than anyone else, and we were surprised to reach the conclusion that, no, they did mean to do this.
And so this case has stuck, and what was once seen as a trivial word omission is now being called an intended principle of the ACA being violated by the feds. Now, there is nothing in the debate over the law that suggests this principle. The law does specifically authorize federal marketplaces. It just says nothing about subsidies in them. And the fact that this was never an issue during the months while millions of people were signing up for subsidies suggests there was agreement somewhere that direct federal subsidies were allowable under the law. John McDonough at Harvard University, who helped draft the ACA when he was an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy, says this wording issue is an extreme technicality.
The intent is abundantly clear, and the context within the law, the broader context, makes it absolutely clear that there's no other interpretation without creating havoc to the law as a whole, which is, in fact, the principal desire of the plaintiffs in this case.
Lawyers will argue what the intent was today in the Supreme Court. Researchers at the Urban Institute estimate that if King v. Burwell strikes down the subsidies, something that could happen when the court rules in June, it would be a $30 billion hit next year to the ACA. It would make coverage unaffordable for many in the 34 states where there are no state marketplaces, and the ranks of the uninsured would increase by an estimated 8.2 million. Something you'll remember that no one wants, even if a committed core of conservatives wants to get rid of Obamacare any way it can.
Don't you someday want to see a woman president of the United States of America?
That's Hillary Clinton speaking at a gala last night for Emily's List, the Democratic organization dedicated to helping women get elected to office. But the Clinton campaign, or non-campaign, or preliminary campaign, has some serious troubles this week. The Clinton Foundation has acknowledged that it accepted money from foreign governments during Hillary Clinton's tenure at the State Department, including one donation that apparently violated an ethics agreement with the Obama administration. And this week's State Department officials said that Hillary Clinton exclusively used her personal email while in office, possibly violating the Federal Records Act.
The fact is, the State Department cannot certify they have produced all of former Secretary Clinton's emails because they do not have all of former Secretary Clinton's emails, nor do they control access to them.
That is Republican Congressman Trey Gowdy. He's the chairman of the committee looking into the Benghazi controversy, and that's another issue dogging Hillary Clinton. Joining us now is Gail Sheehy, author of Hillary's Choice and a contributing editor to Vanity Fair. Welcome, Gail.
I'm happy to be with you, John, as always.
It's great to talk to you again. Now, the Hillary team is very, very well known for circling the wagons here and being incredibly aggressive when there's an attack underway. What's been the response here?
Well, I think the New York Times has come back and the Wall Street Journal this morning and many other outlets, so it's now a three-day story. And I think the main problem is that people were hoping for maybe a new Clinton, more authentic, more transparent, showing that she's learned from the backlash that she's endured over the years for keeping secrets from the public and from herself. That's the other part, kind of the psychological underpinning. Go back 20 years, her response to news organizations and congressional committees about Whitewater was to lock down right from the beginning. And you can draw a line from her locking down about the New York Times asking about Whitewater to the whole chain of events that led to the Whitewater investigation, the special prosecutor, then the investigation of Monica, and ultimately the impeachment of President Clinton. It dogged her their entire time in an otherwise very successful presidency.
And people may say that Trey Gowdy and people like him are ideologically motivated, but the whole vast right-wing conspiracy approach isn't going to fly when you're talking about a foundation that the Clintons control and there were contributions from foreign governments. And, you know, this just isn't going to look very good for a Secretary of State.
Right. And she followed the rules while she was Secretary of State, but then ignored the need to be transparent about donations from foreign countries, many of them very questionable. So to what degree does a President Clinton owe favors to people who have supported the family business?
And people who look at the United States and see this sort of Clinton institution and then see the federal government, you know, if they can't get a response from the federal government, well, just go to the Clinton Foundation. That's just not something that's going to look well during this campaign.
Yeah, it's an alternate route. And I think the question of Hillary literally being able to just completely not know what she doesn't want to know, which started with her not knowing about Bill's girlfriends, although she knew and was fighting it all along. Eventually, you live in your own reality about events that you don't want to have disclosed.
Is having a personal email while you're Secretary of State an example of living in your own reality, or is it just an administrative detail?
I think, obviously, there needs to be a record. The major officer that's dealing with the world on the behalf of the United States, there has to be an archive. It should be readily available. The very fact that it's taken a long time, a couple of years, for this to come up lets you know that it wasn't readily available. And a lot of this is about Hillary keeping secrets from the media, you know, making FOIA requests impossible to fulfill because they can't find the information. The State Department couldn't come up with any information about the Benghazi attacks.
And we remember when Barack Obama was inaugurated, there was tremendous tension over the fact that Barack Obama wanted his own BlackBerry. Remember?
Right. Yeah.
And he wanted to have his own BlackBerry to be able to text his own buddies and that sort of thing. And it created all kinds of protocol issues.
Mm-hmm.
For Hillary Clinton to have been able to have a personal email to do all of her communications at the State Department must have required her making some serious preference decisions to ensure that it worked out that way.
I agree. And then the other question is, what about all the people who worked with her at the State Department? They weren't all necessarily Clinton insiders. Didn't anybody say to her, maybe this isn't a good idea? Shouldn't we check what the rules are? Maybe they don't do it because of the reason that people in Hillary land really rarely tell her the truth about where she's going that may be problematical, is they don't want to get spanked by mama. She has that reputation.
Finally, reporters may view this set of emails as a treasure trove of private correspondence that get behind the veil that actually indicate what Hillary Clinton was or was not doing during the time she was Secretary of State.
Especially her communications with Sidney Blumenthal, her longtime advisor.
Do you think that it's a treasure trove, or is it just going to be an email address like a State Department email address that will have a lot of sort of boring emails connected to it?
Probably a lot of boring emails, but there are probably a few things in there. Not a smoking gun, but I think all around the Benghazi, the preparation, the warnings of it being vulnerable and how she handled that and how she discussed that with people like Sidney Blumenthal, I think that would be all very, very important for the public to know. It might help to exonerate her from attacks by Republicans that are going to be a major part of the campaign.
She's a contributing editor to Vanity Fair magazine. Gail Sheehy is author of Hillary's Choice. Gail, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
So has an email ever gotten you into serious trouble?
Hi, my name is Judith. I'm calling from New Jersey. In the early days of Reply All, I did an accidental broadcast of my less than charitable opinion of some of my coworkers. This did not work out well at all.
Here's Boston, Massachusetts. Yes, who hasn't? Until someone invents the oh no, please unsend command, you can beg and plead, but in the end, email has no sympathy at all.
One time I accidentally added an unintended recipient to a dirty joke and then heard about it from my manager. Only a warning, thankfully.
Tweet us your email woes at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway, or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Getting away from it all is our mission as we look at the newly discovered exoplanets this week, places that might be habitable in galaxies far away. Today, an exomoon. The planet it orbits, if it exists at all, is Upsilon Andromeda D, a Jupiter-like planet a mere 44 light-years from Earth. Some scientists believe the satellites of gas giants in the habitable zones of stars such as Upsilon Andromeda D could be more likely harbors of life than the rocky loner exoplanets. Scientist Sarah Ballard is back today, NASA Carl Sagan Fellow at the University of Washington in Seattle, and if you ask her about a landing on a moon of Upsilon Andromeda D, she sounds like she visited there just last year.
Would be a singular event in one's life. You would see the planet looming in the sky, depending on the time that you landed, depending on the phase of the moon's orbit where you landed, you would see the planet in a different phase, like just as we see our moon in its crescent phase or its quarter phase or its full phase. Depending on when you land on the moon, the planet may be in its crescent phase, And so you would see sort of like a sliver of a planet with its beautiful, tumultuous clouds. On a Jovian planet, you probably have just incredibly complex cloud activity. You would see, not like Jupiter's great red spot. You would see like storms raging on the surface of this planet. Depending on the stellar activity, you would see double aurora. You could see aurora like on the poles of the large gas giant planet that's kind of like your shield. You would see it light up. Those size planets have really strong magnetic fields. That would be a magnificent thing to behold.
And the proximity of this big Jupiter-sized planet would almost be like a second star. So you'd get the light from the planet plus the light from the star, and it would just be a completely different
sky.
Yeah, it would be a different sky. And just like, you know, children on the Earth, like I used to do when I was a little girl, would try to find the moon in the sky. Little children on this moon would try to find the planet in the sky.
If you couldn't find this planet, you know, there'd be something wrong with you, because it's going to be right there.
Yeah, it'll be enormous. If you happen to be lucky enough that Upsilon Andromeda D has rings, you know, it might have rings. You know, in coming into land, you would see these sort of spectacular bands of ice and dust that comprise the planet's rings.
So has there been an exomoon confirmed, even though your face is so exploding with imagination right now and joy about imagining such a thing?
If an exomoon is to be found in the Kepler data, my colleague David Kipping would find it. But the answer is not yet. And yet, they surely must be there. So the question is only, how small must they be to have eluded our detection so far? It would be the type of event, I think, where you would wonder about the real type of life in the universe. Like when I hear my friend and colleague David Kipping talking about exomoons, he emphasizes the fact that these Jupiter-sized planets in the star's habitable zone are much more common than single rocky planets. If even some of these Jupiter-sized planets have moons, they might be the predominant sites of life in the universe.
Listen to you.
You know, and so the fact that we kind of reside on a single rocky, you know, chunk of rock orbiting without like sort of a big brother planet, that might be relatively unusual.
As a scientist, what do you think the principal value is of imagining these places as tangible places that we can dream about, like we dream about tourist vacations or homesteading?
I think that there's two answers to that. There's a value in imagination, you know, as far as like trying to conceive of the universe that we live in. But in truth, I think that that type of imagination is more of a luxury. If anything, being able to envision planets as places should inspire us to remember that our own planet is a relative miracle. You know, the spaceship that we all live on that just happens to be the perfect temperature and perfect for life. It's precious and it's all that we have. If you forget for a moment that we live on a planet ourselves, you know, hurtling through a sterile void, you remember that it has tremendous value to us in a way that I think it's easy for folks to forget.
Thanks so much, Sarah.
You're welcome. That was a pleasure.
Sarah Ballard is a NASA Carl Sagan Fellow at the University of Washington. To see a scientifically valid animated photo slideshow of all the exoplanets and exomoons we're highlighting this week, go to our website at thetakeaway.org. And got any interstellar vacation plans of your own?
This is Jeff Oliver calling from St. Petersburg, Florida. I would jump at the chance to go into space. When I saw the moon landing in 69, and if you ask me, in 2015, what would I see if I looked at the moon? I would say, I'd see Armstrong City, and I'd see Buzzville. And, hey, what are these places?
Hi, this is Jeremiah from Dallas. I used to think traveling through space to a distant planet was great when I was a kid, but the more I've grown up and realized how much I really enjoy social and human connection, I think space would be a very lonely place.
Gary writes on Facebook, what I would want to know is, will there be pie? Dan Ortiz tweets, I'll go to the new planet. We need to send environmentalists first, though, before the capitalists get there and trash another one.
I would love to do that. I don't find that I'm finding work here. Life here on Earth is pretty depressing. So if I had audiobooks and some games to play in space, send me away on something constructive, and I'd be very happy.
Hi, this is Steve from Charlottesville. The only way you'd get me on a spaceship would be if we first found a way to extend our lifespan, because it would suck to be stuck on the bus only to die right when I get there.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. And you can always find me on Twitter at Jay Hockenberry. And remember to check out our slideshow for some truly amazing images of the exoplanets and exomoons scientifically rendered, all that we're discussing this week on the show.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. And Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the second best exotic Marigold Hotel. The new comedy directed by John Madden, starring Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, Bill Nye, Dev Patel, and Richard Gere, in theaters everywhere Friday.
The teenage years are all about change, and recognition of that is a question of law, justice, and even neuroscience that is quietly injecting a climate of change into the juvenile justice system around the U.S. To use prison jargon, it's individualized treatment programs, interventions rather than warehousing, continual follow-up and follow-through that is the new orange these days. Gone is the slap-down punishment approach to juvenile crime that has led to lingering stigma in orange jumpsuits and tagging of young people, shutting them down as hardcore write-offs long before they get a chance at real reform. Judge Denise Cubbin, lead judge of the Lucas County Juvenile Court in Toledo, Ohio, and court administrator Deborah Hodges are a tag team for these kinds of changes. To make their system work better for young people and their families, Deborah Hodges says they looked far and wide at innovative programs around the nation and cutting-edge science about what it is that juveniles are most likely to respond to.
We had lots of kids that were waiting placement in detention and were locked up also as punishment at times. And, you know, the research shows us that locking kids up makes good criminals. We rear criminals. And we did not want to be in the business of doing that. Through the research of the Annie Casey Foundation, our own research, looking at our data, we were able to determine that what we were doing was actually harming kids. Who wants to harm kids? Our bigger goal is to make our community and our society safe and better. So that really drove our reform.
As you looked outside of Lucas County, who was doing this well and who did you model your system after?
There are a lot of pockets of courts across the country who are doing this work well and have been for a while. Chicago always jumps out at me. You know, they are the founding home of juvenile justice in our country. Portland does some wonderful work. There are lots of courts in California that are doing good work. And I have to tell you, there are lots of courts in Ohio and in Michigan that are doing great works. I think the point to be made is that juvenile court across the country is founded on the notion that all children have the opportunity to make important changes in their lives if they are just given proper services and direction.
How does the science make it into the system? Is it expert witnesses on the stand, or is it something that is an expertise that the whole system develops as it approaches offenders?
I think the science comes into the practice a number of ways. At this time, it's coming through a lot of associations and universities that are looking at the work and spreading the word to the practitioners.
And I would add, in Ohio, Dr. Ed Latessa out of the University of Cincinnati started really pioneering. He did a huge meta-analysis of what works, what actually works with juvenile offenders. There's a lot of myths out there about what works with kids. Lock them up is one of them. We now know through child development and brain research that the adolescent brain is, you know, not developed. It's underdeveloped. You know, there's a reason kids act a little crazy and impulsive sometimes.
And John, that is a perfect example of the reason why it's vitally important that courts across the country and those working with children pursue cognitive behavioral therapy.
What does that mean in actual practice, cognitive behavioral therapy, and how do you apply that to an offender who may have committed some sort of violent act of property destruction?
Well, it actually starts with looking at how kids think. We can actually teach kids to make different decisions by teaching them cognitive skills. For example, if a youth has a fight at school, rather than in the old ways, we'd sit down and have a lot of talking about what happened, why did you do this. Now we can actually sit down with the kids and teach them some skills and practice them and give them homework. The probation officers work very closely with the kids now and practice how do you get out of this situation next week when you're at school. So the skill development is critical in giving kids tools to make different decisions.
Can you take individuals into the juvenile justice system without tagging them as sort of problem kids for the rest of their lives?
The mere fact of being put on probation raises a youth's risk to reoffend. So that has really caused us to step back and look at making sure we're not overreacting to normal adolescent behavior. Even if a youth has been charged, we want to make sure that we're not doing anything that is going to deepen that youth into our system. So we, you know, in the October of 2013, we opened the Juvenile Assessment Center. These were kids in the past that would have been brought to juvenile detention because they were arrested and then booked in juvenile detention. Now many of these low-level kids never see detention. They're still brought to the court, but we're very knowledgeable about the harm that we can do to lower-level offenders who should not be in the juvenile justice system.
Can either of you tell me a story of an individual, without using a name, who really ended up in a better place as a result of the kinds of work that you're describing here, who might have ended up in a very different place in the 1980s?
I can think of a youth now, and maybe I'll change a couple of the facts, who committed serious robbery with a co-defendant, had a weapon. He would have been committed to an Ohio State institution 3 years ago. He would have served his time and he would have been returned home to his son that was born while he would have been at the institution. He would probably not have a place to go at home because his mother suffers from significant drug addiction and mental health issues. And today, he served time in our local treatment facility. He had an opportunity to have a relationship with his child while he was in the facility, developed a great relationship with a probation officer who today is assisting him in finding work. While he was in our local facility, he obtained his GED, so he's getting him connected with some programming so that he can get a skill as opposed to going to college at this time. That would never have happened 3 years ago.
You know, I can't understate how much work this takes. You know, the easy thing to do is to lock up people. You know, today we live in a society that over-incarcerated so many people. And, you know, we need to really specifically make sure with kids that we're not going to create that same mistake. There are no simple answers to really complicated issues.
Judge Denise Cubbin is juvenile court judge for Lucas County, Ohio, and Deborah Hodges is the juvenile court administrator.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. ShopKeep, a POS analytics and management system that works to help people grow their businesses. More information at shopkeep.com.
So how do issues that experts consider settled become huge national debates, with political activists taking positions that seem to be at odds with scientific facts?
No, the satellites don't show any warming.
We haven't had any global warming in 18 years and counting.
Basically, global warmists like Bill Nye say global warming will cause many bad weather events. And guess what? Bad weather events happen all the time.
I think the science is far from settled. And for anyone, including Al Gore, to say otherwise is arrogance.
Experts on both sides. They are how the media sets up their debates these days. But as the longstanding battle over the dangers of tobacco shows, media debates can be manipulated with no regard for the scientific truth, sowed with doubt that becomes something to talk about, an issue, a discussion to fill dead air. And any attempt to stop that discussion can easily be cast as suppressing free speech. Experts on the payroll for R.J. Reynolds may tell us there are doubts about the long-term health effects of smoking. Experts working for Exxon may tell us there are doubts about climate change. A new film called Merchants of Doubt is a portrait of people who have become expert at turning these doubts into political delay or even laws.
The reason that we need the science to be wrong is otherwise we realize that we need to change. That's really a hard pill to swallow, that the whole way that I've created my life is wrong, you're saying? That I shouldn't have this house in the suburb, I shouldn't be driving? And along come some people with sowing some doubt, and it's pretty effective because I'm looking for that answer. I want it to be that the science is not real.
The film Merchants of Doubt is directed by Robert Kenner, and Kenner says all of today's Doubtmeisters learned at the feet of the old masters from the Marlboro days.
We look at this thing growing out of tobacco, how for 50 years people were able to create doubt about something where there was no doubt, and they were kind of masterful at it. And these guys went on, as one of them said, if you can do tobacco, you can do anything. They went on from one industry to the next, ultimately up to the biggest payday, which is now climate.
And how proud of their work are they? In other words, do they notch their belt every time they produce this doubt, or do they believe that what they're doing is true?
Well, you know, I think, first of all, it's not one group.
Sure.
Many of them, many of the professionals there are just looking to delay, like the tobacco guys did, for as long as possible, and they're really good. I spoke to one guy, Peter Sparber, who was masterful working for tobacco, who helped slow down legislation on the slow-burning cigarette and was able to convince people it was not cigarettes that caused house fires. It was couches. and he was able to make it a law where you have to put chemicals in these couches that turned out to not prevent fires and also cause cancer. And I'm thinking, that's a brilliant act. And I called him. He had avoided the reporters for years, but he called me back and I'd said, you're so good at what you do. When you say, if you can do tobacco, you can do anything. And I'm doing this film and it's about more than tobacco. It's, you know, lists multiple industries, including climate. And he said, you can take James Hansen, the leading climate scientist, and I could take a garbage man and I could get America to believe that garbage man knows more about climate than Hansen does.
Wow.
And I'm going, he's a very talented man.
What moments in the film struck you as particularly ruthless and cynical, and what struck you as, man, the media just lines up to sort of play this game?
Ultimately, my big takeaway is that, unfortunately, the media made this a debate when it wasn't a debate. The media let us down.
You know, one of the takeaways from this movie, I think, is that freedom of speech, permission to say virtually anything, is not consistent with a pursuit of truth.
James Hansen said that they're acting as lawyers. They're ready to pervert truth to create delay. When they knew their tobacco caused cancer, they weren't going to go out and say it doesn't cause cancer. They'll just say we need more studies. So they'll figure out language that allows them to continue that doubt and delay, but they'll try not to be libelous about it, but yet they are able to fool and ultimately confuse the public.
And free speech protects that confusion.
Yeah, though at some point it ceases to be – at some point, when's it libelous? I don't know.
Who should decide that, do you think? Yeah.
Well, finally, on the cigarette issue, a judge said they have to take out ads saying they lied. It's a shame it takes so long. You know, one guy I spoke to was the Winston man, and he said he was on the set one day and he asked the executives, do you guys smoke? And they said, no, that's for poor people, black people, stupid people. We wouldn't touch the stuff. So, I mean, that was the ultimate, you know, answer of cynicism. Or Sparber saying I can get a garbage man is the ultimate cynicism. You know, meanwhile, they're playing with our planet, and it's terrifying that they're out there. At the same time, you just have to admire how successful they are.
What is the consequence, do you think, of this doubt in terms of the climate and the initiatives to try to fight back on climate change?
Well, one person I spoke to just on a literal level, which was Ron Prin, who was a skeptic at MIT. Most of his funding comes from Exxon, which is the largest sort of funders of deniers, or certainly had been for many years. And he at one point put out a paper, I guess about 5, 6, 7 years ago, saying that maybe it is – man is now starting to – you know, he came late to the party. But mm-hmm. he was a real scientist who was very skeptical. And then Rex Tillerson put out something saying, no, there's still doubt. We don't know. And Ron Prince said, no, we do know, you know. And so I thought, okay, I'll ask Exxon scientists, what do you think will happen by the year 2100? And he said he thinks if we don't change our policy, we'll be up 11, 12 degrees Fahrenheit. Those are numbers I hadn't heard.
And that's Exxon.
His funding comes from Exxon. He's an independent MIT scientist who's a real scientist, but he gets most of, you know, most of his money's coming from Exxon. So, but I think, you know, it goes beyond climate. It's our democracy, because it's not only about – it could be any product. It's about inconvenient science. You know, we love science as long as it doesn't get in the way of profit. And when it gets in the way of profit, all of a sudden we can – we have a class of people who can create doubt about it and make us question it. And at some point, you know, where does it cross the line into libel is the question that I think you brought up, and it's a good one.
Well, the class of people who do this are called Merchants of Doubt in the film of the same name by director Robert Kenner. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Merchants of Doubt opens March 6th. So here's a little something for you to take with you at the end of the hour. How long is your commute? Did you know that until the 20th Amendment was ratified in 1933, today was the inauguration day for U.S. presidents? This was the estimated time using the Google Maps available in 1787, that it would take people to get to Washington, D.C. to begin governing. There were slow-moving horse carts, there were boats, walking, travel by lame duck even. That's what this period came to be called, the lame duck period. However long it took, all the members of Congress had to be there, cabinet secretaries contacted and appointed. It would take months. Why this took until 1933 to change is one of those mysteries of procrastination. Lincoln practically lost the Civil War by the time he was inaugurated. By 1933, commutes had improved. Since then, well, that's another story. Tell us about your commute or anything you heard on this program. Visit us at thetakeaway.org or give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.